The human brain is masterful at self-deception, and that's not always a bad thing. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, June 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Shankar Vedantam talks about his latest book, Useful Delusions. We'll talk about how humans have evolved for truth, story, and the occasionally adaptive self-deception. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports on the death of Lakota elder Leonard Crow Dog. We explore the vigilante justice of the Black Hills with South Dakota humanities scholar Wayne Gilbert. Plus, the South Dakota Shakespeare Festival stages 12th night. That's coming later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Smithfield Foods has a tentative agreement with its union. This comes after nearly 3 months of negotiations and the threat of a strike at the Sioux Falls pork plant. Union members will vote on the deal next week. Tina Gonzalez is a leader in the union. She says the unity and strength of the union surprised Smithfield.
I don't think that they realized and really understood that they would much rather struggle for a couple of weeks or even a month of going out on strike than continue to work under the conditions that they were, than continue to be working for the same amount of money that Taco John's is paying, you know? So I think that those things were a real eye-opener for them.
Gonzalez says the proposed contract preserves a 15-minute afternoon break for all workers. It raises the starting wage from $17 an hour to $18.75, and it provides a $520 bonus. The contract requires Smithfield to work with union leadership on safety plans during any future pandemic or other emergency. It also provides paid grievance leave for workers who lose an immediate family member. Members of the South Dakota College rodeo teams are practicing for next week's college national finals. South Dakota State University qualified 10 team members, 9 qualified from Black Hills State University, 2 from Mitchell Technical College, and 2 from the University of South Dakota. SDSU senior J.C. Hupp was named the Great Plains Region Goat Tying Champion earlier this year. Her horse French Fry was awarded Horse of the Year. Hupp is excited to see how her teammates compete.
Oh, I think we'll be pretty competitive team-wise. I think we could really do some damage. We got some very talented girls going out this year. Probably one of the best teams we've sent out in a while.
The rodeo runs all next week in Casper, Wyoming. The Crazy Horse Memorial recently added 44 more flags to its tribal flags collection, and memorial officials are still looking for more. There are 574 federally recognized Native American tribes in the United States. The Indian Museum of North America at the Crazy Horse Memorial has 138 flags in its collection. Andrew Donahue is the museum curator and director of cultural affairs. He says the flags are an important part of the museum's collection.
It's a symbol of pride, a symbol of representation, a symbol of belonging, a kind of a statement to make that, various tribes and peoples that have given to us. It's a way that they can see that visual symbol of who they are and where they come from.
All 138 flags are on display for the first time this year. They're located in the Cultural Center and covered porch at the Crazy Horse Memorial. We're expecting cooler, more comfortable conditions today, with breezy conditions throughout the state. Today, sunny skies in the west and northeast, mostly sunny skies southeast with likely showers and thunderstorms. Cool highs are expected in the upper 70s west to the lower 80s in the east. That's going to lower later tonight, mainly to 50-degree temperatures statewide. Expect warmer readings for the beginning of the weekend. Sunny skies return Saturday across the state with highs coming back up to the upper 80s to the lower 90s. What we'll see Saturday is what we're expecting on Sunday, highs in the mid-90s with sunny skies, lows statewide are in the 60s. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem has announced the state has entered the Cooperative Interstate Shipping Agreement. The program gives South Dakota meat processors the ability to sell their inspected products across state lines. Dustin Odukoven is the state veterinarian, and he's joining us now with an update. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Loria. Thank you.
Tell us exactly what this agreement provides for local producers.
Well, it's an opportunity for interstate marketing of our state-inspected meat products, and there's still some work to be done. I think what we've accomplished at this point is just being recognized by USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service as having a program that is accepted into that Cooperative Interstate Shipment Program. And so individual state processors, those are small meat processors that are already now inspected by our state meat inspection program, can apply to be a part of this interstate shipment program. And if they're accepted into it, then their meat products get a federal stamp of inspection and can be sold all across the country.
What are some of the next steps as we move through, the agreement, the application, the agreement, and now implementation? What happens next?
Right. So in the establishments that have interest, and we'll be reaching out to each of them, our office has communicated with those establishments about this time last year when we were looking at the possibility of applying for participation here. But they'll have the opportunity to apply, and we will review their facilities again. If they're ready to move forward, we'll have them reviewed by a federal reviewer as well, and they'll be able to start producing their product with that federal mark of inspection.
Does anything need to happen with the number of state inspectors we have, or the accessibility for local producers to have access to those inspectors? Are there any changes that you foresee in that area?
You know, one of the changes we've had to implement already is some of our state inspectors have had to complete federal training, which is very similar to the training they received for the state program. But we do have state inspectors now that have gone through that training and are ready to start inspecting under this new agreement. Aside from that, at least initially, I don't anticipate a huge volume or a change in volume. Many of our plants are already operating at capacity right now. So, as the program grows, perhaps we will need to add additional inspection staff.
Tell me why now, because this is a program that the state has resisted being part of in the past because of reasons you've outlined before. But outline those reasons. What was the hesitation? Is this something that should have been done years ago to support local producers?
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring that up, Lori. I think, we've operated a state meat inspection program that's been recognized as at least equal to by USDA since 1969. And, we do value our state inspection program. I think it's on par with the federal inspection program. And really what we would like is true recognition of that program and the ability for all of our state establishments to market their products in interstate commerce. I think maybe somewhat due to the supply chain disruptions that occurred last year and the lack of forward progress on true recognition of that equal to status, it seemed time to make this opportunity available. So we're hopeful that it benefits some. I think there is the possibility that local livestock producers might use the services of some of these establishments that would participate in the CIS program and then have the ability to market their product outside of the state.
If the state had been part of CIS before the pandemic, what kind of impact might that have had?
Yeah, I don't know that there'd be much difference. I think this creates an opportunity for marketing, but most of the small processors, they're not experiencing, a surplus of product that they don't have markets for. Many of them are booked out, well into next year for their services. And so I don't know that much would have changed. But But this does offer a new marketing opportunity that can be developed.
Dustin Odekoven is South Dakota State Veterinarian. We appreciate the update. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Lori. Have a good day.
Ahead on the program, we remember the life of Leonard Crowdog. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
During the pandemic, live audio chats on apps like Clubhouse and Twitter have taken off, letting people connect online when they can't in real life.
They wanted you to feel like you were hosting people in your living room. Well, that's my thing. I love to have people in my living room.
Meet the people becoming audio stars and the social media companies hoping to turn a fad into a permanent boom. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
Zakiya Delilah Harris knows what it's like to be the only Black woman in the office. Her new book is all about what it's like when another Black woman shows up.
The way that we feel like there can't be that many of us in one space. We have to really only be representative, like, through one person.
Zakiya Delilah Harris on her new novel, The Other Black Girl. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by photographer Paul Horsted and the books Exploring with Custer and Crossing the Plains with Custer. Follow the trail of the historic Black Hills Expedition with rare maps, firsthand accounts, and then and now photographs. More at paulhorsted.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. An internationally renowned Lakota medicine man has died. Chief Leonard Crowdog was a spiritual advisor to many, including the American Indian Movement, during the Wounded Knee occupation in 1973. SDPB's Lee Strubringer spoke with several friends and relatives about the life of Crowdog and brings this story.
Chief Leonard Crowdog passed away on Sunday, June 6th. The Shechangu Lakota medicine man was born in 1942 in the Rosebud Reservation. Crowdog was kept from boarding school education. Milo Yellowhair is an Ogallala Lakota who met Crowdog as a kid. Yellowhair says Crowdog grew up in a traditional way.
He was kept away from schools and from the influences of, you know, even electricity. You know, the grandfathers never lived in with electricity. And they always had a ceremonial lifestyle, you know, which means that. So he grew up in this, and then the energy that creates all of that and come to visit him and makes him a man that can heal, you know, a man that can identify plants and animals that can be helpful to your spiritual upbringing, but also your physical upbringing.
Yellowhair and Crowdog spent time together during the Wounded Knee occupation in 1973. During that time, Crowdog served as a spiritual advisor to the group.
He always talked about the universal person. And in our case, it would be a two-legged being on one world. And he said he was a graduate of the University of the Universe, he always said. It's a very fundamental point of view. It means that, you know, all things that you use on a daily basis to make your life has got to be clean. And you also got to put prayer first in your life. This is something that he always carried with him, no matter where he went.
Rosebud Sioux Tribal Chairman Rodney Bordeaux says Crowdog created a pathway for Indigenous people to follow to restore traditional ways.
He did that throughout his life. He's a staunch supporter of our treaty rights, the return of the Black Hills. And basically, he was one of many that of our people that have gone on that, preserving our spiritual ways, the language, so that we can continue as a people.
Crow Dog's influence is international. He shared Lakota culture across the world. Lloyd Big Crow is one of Leonard Crow Dog's nephews.
He healed a lot of people. You know, he changed a lot of people's lives. Like I said, this is one of the last, you know, great, you know, medicine men. You know, he took a whole generation of knowledge with him.
Big Crow says Crow Dog was always focused on future generations.
Our visits were always about the kids. And he's always talking about, you know, just, you know, like we have a natural teacher and that's the universe itself, you know, like the plants, the animals, you know, we just have to be self-aware, you know.
In 2019, Chief Crow Dog appeared on Oyate Today. It's a program produced by Native Sun News. Crow Dog was asked by host Richie Richards why the Black Hills are sacred.
All the minerals, all the aquifers, stage of aquifers, all there. How we're gonna know is with our spiritual chanupa, chan, a wood, and then ia, the stone, and the little red boy, the red willow, it's there. The divine fire, smoke. And old man looked into that. He said, Monkey Zita, Ia Izita, Manza Izita, the goal is gold. Even then, Manskazi, Manzazi, Letuelo, Lele Agliota Kochtelo, you're going to come back here and settle at one time in times of life. And someday it will be here, remember, not my nation. When he say my nation, it echoes the four directions of the universe.
Do the Black Hills continue to be sacred today then for Lakota people?
I don't care how many Caesarean that she goes through, the Mother Earth, it's going to be holy, it's going to be sacred. It's going to be holy and sacred.
Irregardless of who's currently occupying it or what's currently occupying it, it's going to continue to be a sacred.
That's why Walakota and non-Indians live in the sacred land. They bought some land too. All this, but still the Walakota's dream is there. They could not demolish that. It's there.
Chief Leonard Crow Dog was buried on Monday at his home in Rosebud. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
You can find and share all our stories online at sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, from standing against annihilation to the mythos of Mount Rushmore, we talk Hidden Brain host Shankar Vedantam about the human brain and the need for truth, story, and yes, a little self-deception. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Science Friday, Biden's Assistant Secretary for Health talks about the disparities exacerbated by the pandemic. Also, researchers recount and then report their study errors.
So the bottom dropped out of my stomach and I just started realizing.
Plus, rethinking our robot relationships. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
Program funding by Rise Custom Solutions, wheelchair and mobility specialists, plus expert orthotics, prosthetics, and assistive technology in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, a division of Lifescape. More at risecs.com.
In many languages, nouns are gendered.
Take the word bridge. If it's feminine in your language, you're more likely to say that bridges are beautiful and elegant. And if the word bridge is masculine in your language, you're more likely to say that bridges are strong and long and towering.
Language and how you see the world, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Sunday evening at 6 Central, 5 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided with your annual gifts and by West Hills Village Retirement Community, a nonprofit continuing care community providing gracious and secure retirement living in a pleasant environment. WestHillsVillage.com.
Science and Technology Reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Self-deception does terrible harm to families, communities, even nations. So why are our brains not designed to consistently prioritize the truth? Shankar Vedantam is host of the podcast The Hidden Brain. His latest book is called Useful Delusions: The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. In the book, Vedantam and co-author Bill Messler make a case for the adaptability of self-deception. I spoke with Vedantam about the book.
There have been, you know, countless books and articles that have been written about the downsides of self-deception and delusion. And I think many of those books and articles are informed by the really important insight that self-deception and delusions can be harmful. They can be harmful to people as individuals, to communities, to groups, and to nations. The contribution of my book is that it turns out that self-deceptions can also be good for you from time to time, and there might be situations where in some ways deceiving yourself might in fact produce better outcomes. And so the book, Useful Delusions, is not suggesting that all delusions are useful, but it is suggesting that all delusions might not be dangerous.
And they might be adaptive. They might be there for a reason.
Indeed. At the core of the book is an argument about why our brains work the way they do and how they've come into being. And the book makes the case that our brains are the product of a long process of natural selection and evolution. And natural selection and evolution have built our brains to perform two basic functions: to adapt to the world in which we live and to survive. That's what the brain is there for. Now, if seeing reality accurately helps us, you know, adapt and survive and pass on our genes to our children, then our brains are perfectly capable and willing of to see reality exactly for what it is. You know, if a lion were to suddenly walk into your neighborhood next week, your eyes and ears would pick up on the lion and you would take steps to protect yourself from the predator. Now, on the other hand, if it turns out that there are parts that, if it turns out that not seeing reality accurately is what helps you adapt and survive, it turns out our brains have robust machinery in some ways to deceive themselves. And that's what my book is about, that in some ways self-deception in itself is neither a good thing nor a bad thing. You really have to ask the deeper question, who is it helping and what are its consequences?
So one easy example of this is my child is so brilliant and wonderful and worthy of investment and resources. You know, we think our kid is, and that's just a simple act of wanting to carry on our genetic material in some ways.
Yes, I think it might be sort of perhaps the single most important area where self-deceptions can be useful. I know in my own life, when my daughter was born, I didn't just think that she was the most special child in the world. I thought she was the most special child in the history of the world. and you know, of course, when I stepped back and thought about it, I said, you know, it can't possibly be the case that millions of parents can simultaneously believe their children are the most special child in the history of the universe. They can't all possibly be true at the same time. And yet this delusion, which it is a delusion, turns out to be very useful, because parenting is actually so difficult, so time consuming, so challenging, that the delusions we have about our children serve to buffer us against the body blows that parenting often delivers to us. And so it's the canonical example in my head about the ways in which delusions can sometimes be useful.
All right, so I want to take a darker turn with this and go to something that you cover in the book, Useful Delusions, about bulletproof ceremonies. And we're going to go to the ghost dance in South Dakota and the massacre at Wounded Knee. Because you see throughout different cultures this idea of preparing something, you know, preparing a warrior for battle or preparing people to be invincible in some ways. Mm-hmm. And it ties into this idea that is also central to the book, that we think delusions might be a sign of one thing, but they can be largely a sign of circumstance. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what you saw in your research regarding the ghost shirts and the ghost dance.
Yeah, so almost since the invention of the firearm, human beings have come up with rituals and beliefs that basically tell people that they can become bulletproof. What's fascinating about these rituals and beliefs is that these have popped up in different parts of the world, in different cultural contexts, in different situations. But in all the cases, people are basically saying, yes, we are outnumbered in terms of our arms, in terms of our weapons, but by means of a ceremony or a ritual or a belief, we can make people invulnerable to the trajectory of a bullet. Now, that certainly is what happened with the ghost dance and with the ghost shirts, but it's not the only place in the world where this has happened. And on the surface, that seems like an absurd delusion because, of course, you know, believing that you're bulletproof, I mean, talk about having a falsifiable hypothesis, right? Someone fires a bullet at you, you know, you're going to find out very quickly that, in fact, your bulletproofing ritual did not actually convey bulletproofing. So why is it that these rituals have persisted and why are these beliefs, why have they persisted in many parts of the world? And my book sort of makes the case that even though these beliefs might be false in the sense that they're not actually conveying making anyone bulletproof, they're providing really important psychological assets to people. So people who are outnumbered or greatly endangered are able to band together and fight because they believe that they have been blessed or because they have believed they have become invincible. And in some ways, the ghost shirts and bulletproofing rituals are only a small facet of all the different ways in which soldiers in wartime have come to think of ways in which they might themselves be invulnerable to the challenges and horrors unfolding around them. You know, so people wear, they wear special bands or necklaces or rings or bracelets, or they carry some special object that they believe will protect them. And all of these in some ways are variations on the same idea. Confronted with daunting odds and great terrors, the brain sometimes comes up with mechanisms to protect us from our own fears.
So a group of people facing intentional genocide from an enemy that is, you know, outnumbers them, deceives them, tricks them, and intends to wipe them off the face of the earth, this is a living culture that lives right now. So can you make an argument that some of these adaptations worked in the sense that they still matter to the people today who are descended from the people who survived?
Yes, I think when we look at rituals and basically say, what's the point of this ritual? Because, you know, by definition, rituals are activities that typically have no purpose. That's the point. That's how you define what a ritual is. So when you cross yourself, when you enter a church, or you point heavenward after you score a touchdown on the football field, or any number of cultural and religious rituals, you can ask, what's the point of them? They don't make any sense. Obviously, you're not acquiring any supernatural powers by engaging in the ritual. But it turns out a wide variety of psychological studies show that rituals tend to have psychological benefits for the people who practice them. They help people feel more secure, they reassure people, they calm down people's anxieties. And as you just said, they give people a way to connect with their ancestors, to connect with their larger groups, especially for people who are living through traumatic times and difficult times. It becomes really important to feel there's a part of me that is not just my own mortal body. There's a part of me that's going to live on in the practices and cultures of my groups. And so you often find that in situations of great distress is when people develop rituals and beliefs of all kinds. And part of it is, I believe, an emotional defense system against the threat of annihilation, the threat of destruction, that we seek ways in some ways to protect us from the understanding or the reality that in fact our own lives might be in great danger.
All right, I want to stay in the Black Hills, South Dakota, and take you now to Mount Rushmore, because we are embroiled in this conversation nationwide about American exceptionalism, how we teach history and civics, and perhaps nowhere is that more evident than a president standing at a fireworks display at Mount Rushmore talking about the men who are carved on this mountain. Now, you don't talk about Mount Rushmore in Useful Delusions, but you do talk about this story that we tell ourselves about American exceptionalism. Can you help, help me understand, based on your research, what you're seeing happening in this broader conversation about the stories we tell about America's founding and who founded it?
Absolutely. Let me run a quick thought experiment by you. Social scientists sometimes talk about, you know, the proverbial anthropologist from Mars. You know, what would happen if someone visited us from another planet? What would they see? How would they see us? I want to push it a step further. Imagine you have a visitor who's coming to us from a distant galaxy, you know, many hundreds or thousands of light years away. And this person travels across vast realms of space and time and arrives at this tiny little planet in this obscure solar system, in this nondescript galaxy in one tiny part of the universe. And it's a beautiful planet, this blue planet that's sort of floating in the sky here. And this person from this other galaxy discovers that there are 8 million species living on this planet. But one of these species, human beings, believe that they have the right to carve up this little planet into 190 different territories that they call nations. And they believe so deeply and so fervently in the reality of the lines that they have drawn that they're willing to go to war with one another and not just fight one another, but they're willing to destroy not just each other, but destroy the entire planet because they have armed themselves with nuclear weapons and they would rather destroy the entire planet than sacrifice the integrity of the lines that they have drawn. Now, surely this visitor from a distant galaxy would say, this is clearly a grand delusion. This is a huge delusion that not only millions of people believe in the reality and sanctity of their nations, but they're willing to die for it. They're willing to kill for it. They're willing to destroy the planet over them. Now, you can look at this and basically say, well, nations are a delusion and therefore absurd. But I actually take a slightly different tack, which is I ask, well, why is it that nations came into being? If you accept that, in fact, nations are lines drawn in the sand by human beings. In some ways, they're inventions of the human mind. They are what I would call a delusion. Why do they come into existence? What purpose do they serve? And I would argue that nations, in fact, these delusions that we have about the groups that we live in, serve a very important purpose. So when there's a natural disaster in South Dakota, someone in New York might feel, I need to come to the aid of the people living in South Dakota, because in fact, the people in South Dakota and I are part of this larger group. We're all American. So in some ways, the stories that we tell about who we are and the nations to which we belong allow us to stand shoulder to shoulder with other people. They allow us to accomplish great things together. So when you have contested histories of the founding fathers or contested histories of nations, in some ways, they should not be surprising because all nations in some ways are held together by these stories. And of course, if you look at the founding stories of any nation, United States included, what you will often find is that these stories are based on myths and half-truths and incomplete accounts of what actually happened. And if you look very closely, you can say, well, this is not actually the story of America. The real story of America is something else. But I think that misses the point. The role that the story is playing is not just a factual account of what happened. The role of the story is playing is almost the form of glue. It's holding people together in exactly the same way that stories hold our personal lives together. Stories hold our interpersonal relationships together. Stories also hold groups and nations together. It's not surprising in some ways that those stories are contested, but the fact that they are contested does not necessarily mean that they are worthless.
What if some people are left out of that story?
Often been the case with many nations and many stories. And in fact, it's the story of the United States as well. The stories that the United States has told about its own founding have changed significantly over the last 250 years. And as new groups have basically acquired some political power, they basically said, look, we've been left out of the conversation. The stories now need to include us. And very smart leaders, skilled leaders, in some ways are able to weave together the stories of the past with the stories of the present. So I'm not suggesting for a second that these stories need to be static. In some ways, the very fact the stories are supple, they're malleable, they're adaptable, they evolve, these things are actually what give the stories their power, because as time evolves, as the decades unfold, you know, the story that makes sense to you and I today might not make sense to our children 30 years from now. And it's left to them in some ways to reinvent the stories, to draw from the past, but also to draw from the present and weave together a new story of what it means to be an American.
All right, let's talk about, before we close, some of those questions, that new set of questions that we really should be asking instead of just trying to throw facts at somebody and say, the thing that you are considering is not true, and here's the evidence that I have for it. You suggest that maybe a more thoughtful approach to addressing these delusions is in order.
That's right. I do think that it's in order. And in some ways, this is the heart of the message of the book, which is that when we see other people, their self-deceptions and delusions are plainly obvious to us. One of the paradoxes of the human mind is that the delusions and self-deceptions of other people, especially our opponents, are crystal clear to us, whereas our own self-deceptions and delusions are almost, you know, invisible to us. So it's not surprising that when we come by delusions, we're often upset by them or angered by them, because we feel, how could these people possibly not see reality for what it is? And our stock and trade response is to throw data at them, to throw facts at them, to argue with them. I remember a few years ago, I was having dinner with a friend whom I hadn't seen for some years since we were both in college, very smart man. And he was telling me that he believed that the United States was behind the 9/11 attacks, that the CIA and FBI had planned the 9/11 attacks, and that the United States had carried out the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in order to justify the war in Iraq. And I remember arguing with my friend for about 90 minutes, explaining to him why he couldn't possibly be right, marshaling argument after argument after argument. And of course, at the end of this, the end of the 90 minutes, all that had happened was that we had become a little less friendly toward one another. I hadn't changed his mind on anything. And if anything, he was left with the belief that I was the one who had the delusion. If I was to do that conversation over again, I think I would approach it differently. I would start more by asking questions than basically making assertions. I would start with compassion and empathy rather than starting with judgment and contempt. I'm not necessarily suggesting that empathy and compassion will always change people's minds. In fact, changing people's minds is extremely difficult to do. But I am suggesting that it's more likely to succeed than throwing the book at people of accusing them of being morons and idiots. After all, when was the last time you changed your mind on something you believe deeply just because someone called you an idiot?
Yeah. So let's circle back to our original example, which is, my child is exceptional and the most exceptional child in history. And then that child grows up and starts to reinvent the story of their childhood, and mom and dad aren't as fantastic anymore. There might be another need that that child has other than, what a parent can clearly see as a delusion or a self-deception of their own independence. And that is independence itself. So is there a way to ask questions in a way that don't, in a personal relationship now, I mean, mm-hmm. like, you know, mm-hmm. a spouse, a friend, where the outcome of this conversation does not, public policy doesn't hinge on the outcome of the conversation, yeah. but the relationship does, it might be worth sitting there and saying, what else is this person after? What they yes. really want is connection or love or independence yes. from a parent. Yes. Does that make sense? Does that resonate with you and your research?
It does resonate. I will say that this is so hard to do, because often when we find ourselves in conflict with people, this is not just in the political realm or the geopolitical realm, but in the interpersonal realm, when we have conflicts with our friends, with our loved ones, with our children, with our parents, it's so hard to step back from that conflict and ask, what is this conflict really about? What is this person really saying? What are the needs and anxieties that this person has? What are the dreams this person is trying to express? Maybe they're not saying things in the way they should be saying them. But what if I look past that and ask, what is the dream that this person is expressing? What are the needs they're expressing? I'm not for a second suggesting I'm able to do this. I feel like I fail almost all the time trying to do this. Yeah. But I do believe that when we can do this, we are more effective. Because in some ways, starting with empathy, starting with compassion is the right approach. And we know this because when other people start with empathy and compassion toward us, that's when we respond favorably. Why would other people behave any differently?
Shankar Vedantam is the host of the podcast Hidden Brain. His latest book is called Useful Delusions. Let's take a moment now for poetry. Billy Collins has a new poetry collection called Whale Day. Let's hear more about the poet now with poetry from Studio 47.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Billy Collins. Collins was born on March 22, 1941, in New York City, and has since written 14 collections of work, including The Apple That Astonished Paris, The Art of Drowning, Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes, and Horoscopes for the Dead, among many others. He was appointed Poet Laureate of the United States for two terms, from 2001 to 2003. And after teaching at Lehman College at the City University of New York for almost 50 years, he is retired, but he continues to give readings around the world. Collins's work is playful, humorous, thoughtful, and accessible. Today's poem is Introduction to Poetry. Here we have a narrator that wants people to feel the joy of poetry that he knows. He wants us to be unafraid of poetry. He wants us to enjoy it the same way we enjoy music or a good movie. He doesn't want us to overanalyze a poem too much. Poetry, he suggests, should be fun and not a bunch of hard work. This is good advice. And so, this is Introduction to Poetry by Billy Collins. I asked them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded live to tape at Augustana University, and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
You can find more poetry from Studio 47 on our website or go directly to theirs at ps47.org. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
In many languages, nouns are gendered.
Take the word bridge. If it's feminine in your language, you're more likely to say that bridges are beautiful and elegant. And if the word bridge is masculine in your language, you're more likely to say that bridges are strong and long and towering.
Language and how you see the world, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Sunday evening at 6 Central, 5 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
Stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you, still providing the same quality service you've come to expect. Doing our part to keep you safe at Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Wayne Gilbert looks behind the surface details to uncover the rich, complex stories of history. On June 18, Gilbert will discuss Black Hills vigilantes and their victims for a History on the Lawn presentation at the historic Adams House in Deadwood. Wayne Gilbert is a South Dakota Humanities Scholar and a life member of the Society of Black Hills Pioneers, and he is joining us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio. Wayne, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your approach to history when you say it's not just about what's printed in a paragraph or a chapter in a history book. You're going to dive deeper in your presentations to tell more stories. Talk about that.
In researching history in the Black Hills, one of the great resources has been the Black Hills Pioneer, which is a newspaper that was started in 1876 and has been continuously operated since then. Now, for the first 25 years of the newspaper's operation, its stories have been put onto optical, I've forgotten now. OCR.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it stands for either. But yes, you've been able to access them in new ways digitally.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And to study a topic like the vigilantes in the Black Hills, you spend a couple hours locating the articles, and then you spend dozens of hours reading the articles. And it's, I'll tell you, the OCR access to the Black Hills Pioneer has just been amazing. I've used it in two or three of my other topics that I do, and I can't speak highly enough.
So tell me a little bit about some of the things that you have uncovered. Tell me a story of vigilante justice and really who the victims of it are. Where do you want to start?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is one of the lynching victims in Spearfish was a fellow named George Keating. And he actually had an estate that his widow probated. I don't know how many lynching victims, if any, other than George Keating, had a probated estate. And that was available to me as well through the South Dakota Historical Society as well as the Black Hills Pioneer. He was a cattle thief. doesn't mean he deserved to be hanged.
Agreed,
brutally.
This is the time that we're talking about. What happened to him? Who came after him?
Who went after him?
Yeah.
Well, I know who went after him, circumstantially. Mm-hmm. There was a merchant in Spearfish named Uncle John Cashman who went to the Black Hills Pioneer one day, and there's an article in the paper that said, well, we've addressed the lynching problem in the Northern Hills. And that was before they hanged George Keating. But basically, it was a anticipatory confession. Uncle John, who was a prosperous merchant in Deadwood, Uncle John was a close companion of a murderous fellow named Bill Gay. The two of them went buffalo hunting a lot. And later they broke into the hospital in Spearfish, took out a guy who was innocent, but happened to get caught up in the wrong circumstances in the great Stoneville, Montana, shootout. I can go into that a little bit. I don't know how much time we have. But that fellow's name was Harry Tuttle. He had been badly wounded in the shootout. They dragged him out of the hospital and threw him over the cliff. Indian Springs Gazebo in Spearfish Park, lovely little place, is where Harry Tuttle met his demise.
Wow. I want to ask you this in the interest of time, which is these stories are so fascinating to people today. What do you think drives that fascination?
Oh, it's the romance of the Old West, probably more than anything. We all like to think that it was a wonderful place. And maybe it was. I don't know.
I'm not sure any story that you've told me so far feels like I want to be there.
I do want to say there is a belief that Deadwood was a center of lynching. There were no lynchings in Deadwood.
Really?
Zero.
Just the mythology of Deadwood itself has made us believe
and
that's central.
Huh. I have been to speeches where people who write popular history books have said, well, we all know about all the lynchings in Deadwood. Well, no, we don't, because there weren't any.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can join Wayne Gilbert for this upcoming presentation, and it's part of History on the Lawn at the historic Adams House in Deadwood. It's June 18th at noon Mountain Time. Bring a lunch, bring a lawn chair. It's free for members. It's $5 for non-members. And Wayne, we'd love to have you back, and people should know through the Humanities Council they can have you come often to their programs and give the full presentation, because this is just too enticing. So I hope people come out and see your talk. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a topsy-turvy world packed with festive joy and desperate mourning, mistaken identities, and comedic confusions. The South Dakota Shakespeare Festival presents a professional performance of William Shakespeare's Twelfth Night in Vermilion's Prentice Park. We're joined now by Chaya Gordon Bland, co-founder of the South Dakota Shakespeare Festival and also associate professor of theater at the University of South Dakota. With Chaya is Mia Hiltz, who is the lead actress for this upcoming production. They're joining us from the STBB studios in Vermilion. Chaya Gordon Bland, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laurie.
Mia, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with you, Chaya. The festival's back. There is a program guide packed with lectures and music and performance, and it feels awfully good to have that in front of me, realizing that a pretty good sign that summer is on in South Dakota.
Yeah, it's so exciting after everything that we've all been through this past year to be hearing about all of the amazing programs that are coming back and to be able to contribute to that and have our face-to-face performances as well as all of the accompanying programs which are coming up next week.
All right. Tell me about Shakespeare's Twelfth Night and why this is sort of, the production chosen for this particular 2021 festival.
Absolutely. We had to have some very careful conversations with our board of directors quite early, probably about December, when we were discussing whether or not we would even have a production this year, and did we feel like we could accomplish that in a safe and healthy and responsible way, and what might that look like? And the decision was, yes, we think we can do this, learning a lot from the lessons of USD's theater department. And if we are going to do this, yes, of course, it's going to be a comedy. And not only is it going to be a comedy, it's going to be a comedy that uplifts and inspires and has music and brings joy. That the arts play so many different roles in our lives. And I personally love plays that ask us to go to darker, more critical places. But right now, in this moment, Twelfth Night as a piece that uplifts our audiences just felt right.
Yeah. Mia, tell me a little bit about the show itself for people who are uninitiated and want to know what they're going to experience. And then talk a little bit about your experience in putting this production together with other actors in the same, physical space.
Of course. So Twelfth Night itself has many, many plots, but the plot that I am involved in is that of Viola, this is my character, who is shipwrecked at the very beginning of the play and decides to take on this secondary identity of Cesario, a servant to the leading force in the city of Illyria, or the country of Illyria, mm-hmm. the Duke Orsino. And in doing so, she gets herself kind of caught up in this really wicked love triangle, and she's casts a lot of nets, and things get really confusing, especially when her twin brother decides to show up in town. That adds a whole layer of mistaken identities into the mix, and it's just a joyful, lovely comedy, and it's a journey for me of trying to find my way out of all of these pack of lies that I've gotten mixed up in. And as far as working with the company, yeah, it's just been an insanely incredible experience. I initially auditioned because it was the first audition that came across my plate that was going to be in person. And mm-hmm. that was just so exciting for me, the thought of even just being in the same room as people and performing an audition. And fortunately, I was cast and brought in. And we started out our rehearsal process with lots of COVID restrictions. And fortunately, since then, we've gotten permission to loosen some of those things up. And boy, just the ability to create art in the same space as other people and to look at people's faces and see their full faces and be able to communicate and act with them. It's something I don't really even have words for necessarily.
Yeah, so it's been really beautiful and joyful.
You're both tired of sort of looking at the screen and trying to figure out how you can use that two-dimensional square that is Zoom to create a sense of space, I'm guessing.
That's right. Absolutely.
How close can you look at the camera? What can you do?
Right.
How can these boxes move around? And now all of a sudden you're back. But to that point, Hylas, what did you learn during this time? I mean, like, does that inform at all the work that you're doing now? Now that you are, what's the next normal? Do you just go back to the way you did it before? Are there lessons to take from those sort of virtual performances and connections that we all experienced in the past year? You say, I'm going to take this forward as an art form.
Yeah, that's a really great question, Laurie. And I think it's really important that there are a lot of wonderful lessons to be learned from what was a very, very difficult time. And I think in every field and in every area, there are things that we're learning. So for sure, we're going to take some things forward with us. One of the most tangible things that we're going to take forward is that there are ways to make work more accessible. Mm-hmm. And we had to make work more accessible when everybody was stuck in their homes. But why can't we keep that? So, for example, we are doing a video stream of this production as well. So the in-person festival is June 17th through 20th, coming up next week here in Vermilion, in the park and in the library and all of our spaces. But not wanting to necessarily presume that everybody would be comfortable with that, the following week we are offering a video stream of the full production. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to keep that piece because even when we don't have to worry about gathering, that allows audiences far and wide to be able to enjoy the work. It also gives us an archive of the work. So that's certainly one thing that we're going to take with us moving forward. I think that some of our auditioning processes and what have you might also be a little bit streamlined and simplified and moving forward. But I think the kind of more sentimental takeaway is just what Mio was talking about. I'm actually in the production this year as well. I'm playing Olivia, so I get to play with Mia on stage, and it's a blast. But I think that more sentimental takeaway is just that deep appreciation for each moment in our lives and for each of those opportunities to come together, to gather, to create, to co-create, right? Mm-hmm. And to have faces and voices and contact and proximity and to really cherish that.
Well, the South Dakota Shakespeare Festival presents Twelfth Night, or What You Will, by playwright William Shakespeare. Those performances again, June 17th through the 20th in Vermilion's Prentice Park. Pre-show performances and vending starts at 6 p.m., curtain at 7, and then that video stream June 24th through the 27th. We'll put a link up on our website that you can find all this information and everything else that goes into the production. Both of you, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. And thank you for listening.
Thank you.